You've seen our research on social media. Now, join us as we dive deeper into the public health topics of our time, featuring new studies and findings generated by our faculty and researchers committed to advancing health equity. From the Department of Population and Public Health Sciences at Keck School of Medicine of USC, this is Preventive Pros, the podcast.
My name is Jesse Goodrich, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Population and Public Health Sciences at USC. I'm in the Division of Environmental Health, and I'm a member at the Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center.
My research focuses on understanding how environmental chemicals impact human health and disease. Previously, I did a postdoc also in the Division of Environmental Health here at USC. Per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are a common class of persistent organic pollutants. They're also known as forever chemicals because they don't naturally break down in the environment. And unfortunately, they have really long biological half-lives, which means that after someone is exposed to these chemicals, they can actually stay in your body for many years. Some of them can actually stay in your body for up to 7 to 10+ years. PFAS have a lot of different health effects. They're known as endocrine disrupting chemicals, which means that they can interfere with your hormones to cause a lot of different health problems. PFAS were first developed in the mid-20th century, and they've been widely used in a lot of different applications, including both industrial and consumer products, for about 70+ years now. Some of the more common places that people may have heard of these forever chemicals being found is things like nonstick cookware, but they're also found in a lot of different things like waterproof clothing, firefighting foams, and even some cosmetics such as mascara and even lipstick. So as evidence of PFAS and their environmental persistence and toxicological effects have emerged over the past 10 to 20 years, we really have started to understand how PFAS are a really significant environmental health issue affecting communities worldwide. Although public awareness of this issue is increasing, there are still relatively few public regulations in place to actually prevent human exposure to PFAS. So because PFAS persist in the environment and they don't break down, PFAS are detectable in many different drinking water systems across the U.S. And traditionally, it's been thought that one of the main sources of PFAS exposure is through drinking water, and that is very important. But more recently, it's become clear that people are also exposed to PFAS through the food supply and their diet. One issue, though, is that there's so many different types of foods that people eat, and the source of these foods can vary really significantly from region to region. So it's difficult to try to figure out what types of food people should avoid in order to reduce PFAS exposure. So in our most recent study, we set out to examine this question using a kind of unique approach. We used two different cohorts to look at whether self-reported dietary intake was linked to different levels of PFAS in people's blood. Both cohorts included young adults because we were interested primarily in looking at this specific life stage. This is because during young adulthood, lifelong dietary behaviors are developing, and those behaviors can actually impact dietary intake throughout the rest of adulthood. The first cohort that we looked at was a mostly Hispanic group of young adults who were recruited from Southern California. This cohort underwent two different visits. At the first visit, participants were asked a really detailed questionnaire about what different types of food people consumed over the last 24 hours. These were repeated two different times so we could make sure that the assessment was more reliable. We also then measured levels of PFAS at both baseline and follow-up in people's blood. And our main goal, the main thing we were looking at, is whether different foods that people reported eating, if those foods were actually associated with different levels of PFAS. One of the unique things about this study is that it was actually the first study to look at longitudinal changes in PFAS, so whether dietary factors were associated with differences in PFAS over time. We then included a second cohort, which was more of a nationally representative population of youth and young adults. And in this cohort, participants performed one visit. And during that visit, dietary intake was collected in using kind of the same methods. So using a 24-hour dietary recall, and PFAS measures were taken in blood. And in this cohort, we looked again at whether dietary intake was associated with differences in PFAS levels. So far, we don't think that there's really a safe level of PFAS. There's more guidelines that are coming out recently about levels that we know are more harmful, but there's not really a safe level of PFAS. Our primary findings from the study were that PFAS levels were higher in people who reported eating specific foods and drinking some types of beverages. These foods included eating processed meats and pork. So people who ate more processed meats and pork were tended to have higher PFAS levels. But we also saw that people who drank tea were also more likely to have higher PFAS levels. The other main finding from our study was that PFAS levels were lower in people who reported eating more food that was prepared at home as opposed to prepared outside of the home, so takeout or at restaurants, that sort of thing. Some of these results are very similar with the previous literature. So, for example, several other studies have shown that containers for fast food and takeout can have PFAS in them. And that's a possible explanation for our findings that people who ate out less had less PFAS. As a side note, in the US, the FDA just announced that all packaging, all food packaging, has to be PFAS free in the next 6 to 12 months. So that's actually something that hopefully is going to improve over time. But we also saw some unexpected findings. This was particularly true for our finding with tea. So in both of the cohorts that we looked at, PFAS levels were higher in people who reported drinking more tea. And this finding was surprising to us, and it got a lot of publicity. It was surprising to a lot of people. One of the limitations about our study is that we didn't actually measure the PFAS directly in tea. And so while we can hypothesize about why we observe higher PFAS in people who drink more tea, we don't yet know exactly what's driving that. One of the hypotheses that we had was that PFAS in tea may be coming from the drinking water that was used to prepare the tea. But we were able to partially rule out that hypothesis because we also looked at whether drinking more tap water was associated with higher PFAS levels. And there was no relationship between the levels of tap water that people reported drinking and PFAS levels. So we're pretty sure that that association wasn't driven by tap water consumption. So there's a couple of caveats to keep in mind when interpreting our study. The big one is obviously that this is an observational study. And so we're really primarily looking at correlations. And so that means that we can't directly say that PFAS levels are higher in tea. Another limitation of this is that because of the way that we measured PFAS or the way that we measured diet, we weren't actually able to determine specific brands or types of food and beverages that were being consumed. And so, you know, looking back at tea, we can't say for sure what type of tea may be driving the association. And so we're following up on this research by actually going out and looking at the top five brands of tea in the US and actually measuring PFAS directly in those most popular teas from those top five brands. And that's going to help us understand a little bit better what is driving some of these associations. So this research fits into my larger lab group's research goal of really trying to help develop approaches to identify and prevent public exposure to environmental chemicals that can harm our health. That means that it's really important for these types of findings to be conveyed to both the public and policymakers, because while we aren't able to directly measure PFAS in all of these different food products, you know, we can't go out and test every type of pork, for example. The goal of our research is to identify new ways that we can actually identify what types of food are contaminated with PFAS. And hopefully that can help develop new approaches, both at the private and governmental level, that will actually help to measure PFAS in different types of foods. So by raising this issue, we hope that more companies and more government agencies will actually start measuring PFAS in different types of foods to help prevent PFAS exposure. To protect human health from these chemicals, it really takes a two-pronged approach. The first issue is really to reduce human exposure to these chemicals. The most important thing that you can do if you have high levels is to figure out why you have those high levels and stop the exposure immediately. But that still leaves the issue of what to do if you've already been exposed. And that's the next research area that my research is really going towards, is trying to figure out what types of interventions people can do to prevent the harmful effects of PFAS exposure, since they can stay in your body for so long. One potential intervention or approach to actually prevent the health effects of PFAS is leading a healthier lifestyle, specifically related to exercise and diet. And the reason that is that one of the main effects of PFAS is to actually impact metabolic health. So it impacts things like obesity or type 2 diabetes. And some of those health effects actually can lead to other worse diseases later in life. So basically, some of the harmful effects of PFAS, we believe, are coming because they disrupt metabolism. And right now, the best way, or one of the best ways that we have to fight that, is these healthy lifestyles, like getting more exercise or eating healthier. So the good news about PFAS is that since there's been so much recent press and publicity around this issue, and since we now know so much more about their harmful effects, there's been a lot of recent legislation that focuses on banning PFAS from different consumer products. So I already mentioned the legislation around PFAS in food containers. But there's other types of proposed legislation around PFAS in drinking water as well. And I think that we're really starting to have an impact on actually getting companies' attention, so that companies will start to voluntarily phase out all PFAS in their products. And I think that that's starting to happen. I think that a lot of the research that we've been doing is really pushing companies towards doing that voluntarily, and I think that's a really positive sign for the future.
Preventive Pros, the podcast, is produced by the Department of Population and Public Health Sciences at Keck School of Medicine of USC. To learn more about any of our episodes, or to subscribe to our monthly Preventive Dose newsletter featuring the latest in public health research and news, visit pphs.usc.edu/podcast. Thank you for listening.